Dwayne just led us in a hymn, "It Is Well With My Soul." And this hymn, completely coincidental that he would lead this, and it fits so well with what our lesson's going to be this morning. But the hymn reminds us that in the midst of life, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, you have taught me to say, it is well with my soul. And then the second verse, though Satan should buffet, though trials should come, let this blessed assurance control, that Christ hath regarded my helpless estate and has shed his own blood for my soul. And then the last verse, verse 4 in particular, Lord, haste the day when the faith shall be sight. The clouds be rolled back as a scroll. The trump shall resound and the Lord shall descend. Even so, it is well with my soul. When we sing this hymn, there's a whole bunch there that we're singing to one another and that we're claiming on our own benefit as well. We are saying for ourselves and to each other that because of the Lord, because of what he has done, we have the opportunity to be saved. And that when that day comes, when Christ does come back, it is going to be well with my soul. That moment will be a great moment because I will be in a state, I will be prepared to be redeemed, and I will have a home in heaven forever. In the passage that Neil read in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul, in the midst of his writing to the Corinthians, he is going to remind them of so many different elements between 1 Corinthians chapter 12, chapter 13 about love, chapter 12, chapter 14, in the midst of all that, the love is the spiritual gifts. And he wants these brethren to be equipped, to be prepared, to know what's coming, so that they can guard against temptation. When we sing a hymn like, "It Is Well With My Soul," I'm singing, I'm proclaiming, I'm edifying and encouraging that we, all of our souls, it is well with us. We are in a state that is a saved state because we are following the will of God. And because of following that will, we have learned to discipline ourselves. We have learned to submit ourselves to what God tells us to do. And as such, we have learned to overcome temptation. Maybe not 100% of the time. Maybe there are times where temptation sneaks up on us and without us even realizing in the moment, we realize afterwards we've done something wrong. But we always seek to make it right and we always seek to be better than what we are. We're seeking to improve. We're seeking to strive to be better. Paul ends chapter 9 in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. He ends with the recognition that this striving for perfection, ultimately the striving for salvation, notice how he describes it as a race that is to be won. He describes those who run in a race all won, but only one receives the prize. He mentions the fact that we must discipline ourselves. As Paul says, I discipline my body. I bring it into subjection lest after I've preached to others, I myself would be disqualified. Paul is providing the means by which he can say that it is well with his soul. He was running the race as if there's only one prize. He had trained himself not to fight and beat the air, but to be accurate, to know what it is that he's doing. He had disciplined his body. So when he comes into 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and starting at verse 1, he wants the Corinthians to know that there is a lot that we need to learn from the mistakes of the past. Notice the comparison. Notice the contrast from 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and around verse 24 through 27 compared to Israel. Paul, on the one hand, describes his state, his disciplining himself, his striving to be better than what he is, And notice verse 1 of chapter 10 that Neil read. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all of our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They may not have realized it when they were doing it, but as the cloud was guiding them, remember the pillar of fire at night and the cloud by day, that God guided them through the wilderness. But as they were passing over through the sea, Moses separated the sea through the power of God and the cloud, they were encompassed in water. And to that end, they were baptized, they were committed, they were given over to the direction of Moses, is what Paul's describing. He says, verse 5, this is what they were given to. But, and they were given direction, they all ate the same spiritual food, they all drank the same spiritual drink. They were all given the direction of the old law. They were all given what God wanted of them to be faithful, just like he's given to us. Verse 5, but with most of them, God was not well pleased. For their bodies were scattered in the wilderness, and these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. That does not go along with striving in this race as if there's only one prize to win. To discipline my body, to bring it into subjection to the will of God. Notice the example. Israel isn't that much different than we are. They were given direction from God, but they did not discipline themselves. They gave themselves over to lust. Verse 7, do not become idolaters as some of them were, or commit sexual immorality, verse 8, or tempt Christ, verse 9, or complain, verse 10. Verse 11, these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. We, upon us, the ends of the ages have come. We are in the final age. There are no more ages. No more ages of man. We are in the last days, the last age. The final dispensation from God to man of what his will is. There is no more source of spiritual drink or spiritual food than what Christ has given us. This is it. And as such, notice how that Paul compares how that Israel did not discipline themselves. They did not focus on serving God. They did not bring themselves into subjection. And that should serve as an example for you and for me. These things happened to them as examples. They were written for our admonition. The concept of admonition is it can be negative. It can be even if it's harsh, but it's always intended to correct, to point out areas that need to be strengthened, whether that's done in a way that hurts someone's feelings or not, whether it's a way that is harsh or blunt or not, it is intended out of love to correct. That's what admonition is. These things were written for us so that we, when we look at them and we compare what God expected of them, it's no different. People of faith, even under the old law, even under the patriarchal law, they were to be people of faith to us today. Therefore, verse 12, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. We want to talk about this morning overcoming personal temptations. We all have strengths and weaknesses. We all have things in our lives, situations that arise at work, with family, with friends. Maybe it's our own personal mind, our own personal heart, things that we deal with that maybe nobody else knows about. These trials that we face, that sometimes come with these trials, the temptations to not be what we should be, to not do what we should do, to maybe do something that we should be doing, but I don't really want to do that. These temptations and trials, we face them every day. And we all know what our greatest strengths, areas that we are the least likely to fall. We know what that is. We know the areas, perhaps, where we're weakest. Where we know certain areas, certain things that that I just can't involve myself in, certain places I can't go, certain things I can't allow myself to listen to or to see. But you know what? Out of all of that, there's someone who perhaps knows our strengths and weaknesses even better than we do. And if you're going to say God, yes, God, primarily. But guess who else knows our strengths and weaknesses better than we do? Satan does. Satan knew Israel's strengths and weaknesses. And Satan preyed on Israel. And he caused them to fall time and time and time again. Satan doesn't enter into the equation here that Paul describes. He doesn't use Satan's name. Because the responsibility fell on the people of Israel to do what God told them to do, and they didn't do it. Why? Because some were idolaters. Some committed sexual immorality. Some tempted. Some complained. Some focused on themselves instead of focusing on God. That's what it all boils down to. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed. Even in the areas where we think we are the strongest, be careful. Areas that we think we would never fall to that kind of temptation, we would never sin like this or like that, be careful. Because what we think are strengths that no longer need to be thought about, no longer need to be addressed, no longer need to be shored up, sometimes those strengths can quickly become weaknesses if we don't pay attention any longer. Israel was given the law. They had Moses. They had God guiding them in the wilderness. God gave them food. He blessed them over and over again. And over again they turned away. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands. The whole point that Paul describes here is coming off the heels of the end of 1 Corinthians 9. Disciplining ourselves, bringing our bodies into subjection of what God wants us to do. You cannot afford for a moment to lose focus, to lose sight that my goal is heaven. My goal isn't anywhere here on this earth. The end result, the end zone for me has nothing to do here on earth. It has everything to do with heaven. That being the case, I have to always ask myself before I do something, before I think something, before I say something, is this going to be a benefit for me to help get me to heaven, or is this going to hurt me? Is this going to put me in a situation where I could be tempted, where I might sin? That's why Paul tells the brethren, therefore let him who thinks he stands. Israel, time and time again, got overconfident. Time and time again, they took for granted all the blessings that they had from God, starting right there when Moses went up the mountain to receive the law. They took for granted the very God who led them out of Egypt. And from that point, they made it a habit over and over of becoming overconfident, of taking God's blessings for granted. Especially in our nation, the wealth, the relative wealth that we have, the luxuries that we have, far and beyond just the necessities of survival. Survival doesn't even necessarily enter into our minds in our nation, in our present day, because really what we're more focused on are the extra things. We've got the survival element taken care of. It's all this extra fun stuff that we like. The luxuries that we enjoy. Luxuries are fine. They're wonderful. They're blessings from God. But do not allow yourself to become blinded by what is happening around you. The fact that even though these luxuries are here to enjoy, Satan is lurking in the shadows. Because sometimes we can become lackadaisical. We can get into our zone, into our groove, kind of going through the motions, our routine, and out of nowhere, some temptation will approach us that maybe 10 years ago I wouldn't have even thought twice about, but all of a sudden, because I've kind of just allowed myself to be lulled into this false sense of security, into this earthly mind that our world tends to project towards us, we can so easily fall even to sins that maybe at one time we were very strong against. Now that temptation finds a foothold in our heart and our mind. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands. The whole object is, don't think you're standing on your own. You don't have the power to stand on your own. Philippians chapter 4 and in verse 13, Paul says, I can do all things. Remember, this is on the heels of having said, I have learned in whatever state I am therewith to be content. I've learned how to be full and to be hungry. I've learned how to be how to have blessings and how to suffer need. He says, I can do all things, not on his own. I can do all things. I can do all things through my own ability. I can do all things through my own intelligence. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Paul never allowed himself to think of himself more than he should. He warned saints time and time again about that very danger. Paul, an apostle, Paul, inside him. He always remembered that he was but a human being, that God was using for his purpose, and that Paul, only through the strength of Christ, did the things that he did. In Hebrews chapter 12 and in verse 14, the Hebrew writer says, pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord, looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. Lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. The Hebrew writer says, looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. Over and over again in the New Testament, the apostles and the writers of the New Testament warn us. They tell us to be watchful, to be careful, to be circumspect, to be aware of yourself, because you never know where sin is waiting. But then Paul goes on to say in verse 13 of 1 Corinthians chapter 10, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. There is nothing new. Doug and I were just actually talking about, in between class and worship, the fact that, you know, the years go by, generation comes, generation goes, technology increases, the things we can do today would be unthinkable 1,000 years ago, even 100 years ago for that matter. But people are always people. You take away the technology, you take away the luxuries, we are no different than people 1,000 years ago. We're still the same. And the things that man desires, the lusts of the flesh, the lusts of the eyes, and the pride of life that John tells us about in 1 John, all any manner of sin will fall into one or more of those three categories. Because this is our life. This is what we're used to. This is what we can relate to. But none of this matters. Paul says, no temptation has overtaken you. You are not unique in the perspective that what you have faced, you alone in the history of Christian kind, you are the only one that has ever faced it. Not going to happen. The devil doesn't have that many arrows in his repertoire. Man, if you faced it, if you're being tempted by it, you can guarantee that other Christians throughout the generations have faced it too. Satan may dress it up. He may wrap it in technology. It may go by a different name. It's still the same temptations over and over. Don't think that what you're facing hasn't been faced before. And to that end, don't think that what you're facing hasn't been conquered and overcome by saints of faith before. No sin, no temptation, you will not face anything that cannot be conquered through Christ. Notice how Paul goes on to say, God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. God keeps reins on Satan. Just as with Job, he gave Satan limitations in what Satan could do to Job. First, it was, okay, just don't touch Job's body. You cannot hurt him. You cannot kill him. Do what you will, but don't touch Job. Satan failed. He failed to break Job. He comes back, oh, well, you know what? If a man loses his health, he'll curse you. Okay, you can do what you will to Job, but you can't allow him to die. He can't kill him. So he loses his health. His friends turn on him. His wife turns on him. Still, Job remains faithful. Paul tells us that God is faithful. In Hebrews chapter 4 and in verse 14, this is part of the Hebrew writer's presentation of the gospel and to that end, Jesus as the Messiah. In a different way, to bring about to the Hebrews a deeper understanding of the glory and the majesty that is the Son of God. The Hebrew writer doesn't just present Jesus as Messiah. He doesn't just present Jesus as King. He presents him as High Priest. Verse 14, seeing then that we have a great High Priest who has passed through the heavens, that is to say, he died and was resurrected, never to die again. He's passed through the heavens. Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Jesus was in all points tempted just as we are. Does that mean he faced every single temptation that an individual can face? I don't know. But I know he faced temptation. In fact, he faced temptations that even I as a physical man can't face. Not only did he face temptations as a human, he faced temptation as the Son of God. If you really are the Son of God, take these stones and turn them to bread. Well, Satan can come to me and tempt me to do that, but there's not going to be any part of me that even thinks I have the ability to do that. Jesus, on the other hand, being given that power of God, it was that he was being tempted to use to turn those stones into bread. At one point, Jesus was a youngin'. Think about Jesus. He's 10 years old. He's 12 years old. We even see an event when he was 12 years old where he ends up in Jerusalem and he stays and he's lost for a couple of days. His parents can't find him as they're heading back. They go back, they find him in the temple. Jesus was a teenager. What was Jesus like as a teenager? He never sinned, I'll tell you that. But did he face sexual temptation? Probably. I mean, Jesus had hormones. Jesus, everything you and I face as a teenager, the temptation to rebel against our parents, temptation to stay out later than we should have, all that, Jesus, he was a teenager. The only thing Jesus had as an advantage, there are people who think, well, Jesus used his power as God to avoid sinning. That is not what the Hebrew writer says. The only advantage Jesus had was that he remembered, he knew what glory he once had with the Father before he came to earth. That motivated him to go back to that right hand of the throne of God. That motivated him to go back to receive that glory once again. That's the only advantage Jesus had as a human being on this earth. He knew what heaven was like. Which tells you and me a little bit of something, doesn't it? That heaven was so much more wonderful, so glorious, that it trumped anything that this world could offer. So much so that Jesus was completely perfect. It is to that that the Hebrew writer appeals when he says, "Let us therefore come boldly." Jesus knows what we're going through. He's been there, he's done that, and he conquered it. "Be of good cheer, I have overcome the world," Jesus told the apostles. Our Messiah has overcome the world. He's overcome sin, he overcame temptation, and now he's right there ready to help us as high priest of the true temple of God. "Therefore let us come boldly, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." Because God cares about us. That's what else we see in verse 13. God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. You're never going to be put in a position where you have to sin, where you don't have any choice. "I simply can't help but to sin." That is not going to happen. Every temptation you face, everything that you face in this life, can be overcome. But remember, it goes back to the end of 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Disciplining our bodies, bringing it into subjection to the will of God, unlike what Israel did. And Hebrews chapter 2 and in verse 14, the Hebrew writer says, "Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself," talking about Christ, "likewise shared in the same." He became flesh and blood as well. "That through death he might destroy him," Satan, "who had the power of death," that is the devil, "and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage." The bondage of sin, and through sin the death. Verse 16, "For indeed he does not," talking about the Father, "give aid to angels, but he does give aid to the seed of Abraham." Paul says the seed of Abraham is Jesus in Galatians chapter 3 and chapter 4. But notice what else the Hebrew writer says here in verse 17. "Therefore in all things he," Jesus, "had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself suffered, being tempted, he is able to aid those who are tempted." Because we are a part of Christ Jesus, we become part of the seed of Abraham. And as such, he does not give aid to angels. He does give aid to the seed of Abraham. Who's that? Jesus and all of those who are heirs with Christ. "Therefore the Father has appointed the means of that help through his Son as high priest." Just as Christ, he suffered, he was tempted, he's able to help us. 2 Peter chapter 2 and in verse 4, "If God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment," verse 9, "then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. And especially those who walk according to the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise authority. They are presumptuous and self-willed. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignitaries." Notice the characteristics Peter describes of these individuals that are reserved under punishment, notice how similar those characteristics parallel the characteristics that Paul brings out in 1 Corinthians 10 about Israel. Uncleanness, despising authority. So different. Presumptuous, self-willed. I guarantee you at some point in time, every one of us in this room has been exactly this. At some point, every one of us has been presumptuous and self-willed, unclean, and we've despised authority. At some point. But now we have been washed. We have been cleaned. We have been sanctified. We have been purified. The Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation. In James chapter 1, this will be the final passage for us this morning. In James chapter 1, starting in verse 2, James says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing." Remember what we talked about at the beginning of the lesson? We all face trials and temptations. There's a reason we use that phrase like that. Trials themselves aren't necessarily temptations. Trials are tests. The temptation comes when the opportunity to fail that test is so appealing. And that's really what it is. Because trials of this life, it's easier to fail those trials. To do what I want to do. Things that make me feel good. Things that make me happy. As opposed to enduring that test and remaining faithful to God, even though I may suffer in the interim. The trial is the source of the testing. The temptation is my perspective of that trial. Trials and temptations. It all depends on how I'm seeing that trial play out. If I see it as a burden, if I see it as unfair, if I see it as producing unhappiness in me. That's why James says, count it all joy. Count it all joy. You think it's happy to be put through trial? Not necessarily, no. But remember, we've talked before about the difference between happiness and joy. Happiness is an emotion. It comes, it goes, sometimes for reasons, sometimes for no reason whatsoever. Joy is the state of recognizing that I have been blessed by God. So even in the midst of testing, maybe I am suffering hunger, as Paul did, Philippians 4. Maybe I'm suffering need, as Paul did in Philippians chapter 4. I have learned in whatever state I am therewith to be content. Contentment and joy go hand in hand together. Joy says, even when I see things that I'm lacking, I know He's still with me and He's still blessing me. Contentment says, I'm okay with that. So when James tells us, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, it doesn't mean you have everything you want. It doesn't necessarily mean you have everything you need in this life. But God is always with you, and you have everything you need that pertains to life and godliness. Verse 12. This is why James says what he says in verse 12. He talks about the trials. He talks about the patience that comes from it. He talks about the joy it should be bringing about. But what also comes with testing? What also comes with trial, James? Blessed is the man who endures temptation. Not trial. Temptation. Because Satan is going to be pulling at you so hard, trying to get you to do things you know you shouldn't do in the midst of, well, God's being unfair. That thought being thrown in you, in your head. The world constantly bombarding us with, oh, look at all the fun I had this past weekend, but you went to church and you did your godly stuff. Blessed is the man who endures temptation. In the midst of the trials, here comes the temptation. For when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. When we endure the trials, when we overcome the trials, and we have been faithful in those trials, the crown of life is promised to us. Verse 13, let no one say when he is tempted, here's the trials, here's the tests, here comes the temptations, I'm tempted by God. God's tempting me. He's trying to get me to fall. He's trying to get me to give up. God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. Each one is tempted, James says in verse 14, when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. The presentation of that may come from Satan. But it's because of my own desires that that temptation has any teeth. That's what it boils down. Notice Satan isn't mentioned here. Verse 12, 13, 14, 15. We can't claim, oh, it's Satan's fault that I fell. It's Satan's fault that I sinned. No, no. The responsibility is on me. That's why James focuses on you and me. When he says, each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. If it's not a part of your heart and mind, if it's not something in you that you desire, Satan wouldn't be able to entice you. Then, when desire has conceived, that desire then is brought into action. That action is sin. Gives birth to sin. Sin, when it is full grown, sin that is forgiven, sin that is turned away from, sin that is repented, it doesn't bring forth death. But there is sin that brings forth death. When I allow myself to remain in that sin, to remain in that habit, to remain in that state of mind, that this is just this little itty, God, you've got 95% of me. Let me have this 5%. Let me have this one little vice, Lord. This one thing I just can't live without. Sin, when it is full grown, it starts taking over. All my thoughts, all my actions, it's all about this. Brings forth death. Because then it's not about God. It's not about serving Him. It's not about Jesus. It's not about heaven any longer. It's about whatever it is in this earth that I like, and I don't care what God says. That brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. Our God only blesses us. He does not send evil. He may allow bad things to happen, but Satan's at the root of that, not God. Satan, through the sinfulness and evil nature of man, can hurt innocent people, not God. God is the Father of lights. There is no variation or shadow of turning. God never changes. God changeth not. He is always faithful. Of His own will, He brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of His creatures. By the word of truth, He brought us forth. By God's word. How? I recognized what God wanted. I turned away from what I know I shouldn't be doing. The sinfulness that was once that old man. I crucified him on the cross. And now I've turned to do what God tells me to do. God brought me forth. He bore me through the word of truth, because I discipline myself. I bring my body into subjection so that one day I can have a home in heaven. And I learn from the mistakes of the past. I learn from Israel. And I make sure that I train myself to know what my strengths and weaknesses are. I train myself that when I begin to be tempted, I go to God in prayer. I open up His Word. I read about Jesus' crucifixion. I read other passages that take my focus off of whatever it is that's tempting me and recenters it on God. You know, it's easier to say, you know, just distract yourself. When you're being tempted, just distract yourself. That's easy to say. It's not always easy to do. But God has equipped us with everything we need to overcome sin, to avoid temptation. The simple question is, am I willing to do it? Am I willing to be baptized, to have my sins washed away? Am I willing to, if I become a Christian, to change my life if I am serving things I know I shouldn't be doing? God is faithful. He will never put you in a position where you can't be saved. Not going to happen. It's all on you and it's on me. Can't blame Satan. Can't blame my parents. Can't blame my preacher. Can't blame my elders. Can't blame anybody. It's on me. Am I willing to do what God tells me? The invitation is extended. If you're subject, please come forward as we stand and sing.